Roughly 2,500 years ago, an old man by the name of Lao Tzu decided to quit his job and live in the mountains. For many years, he had served as the keeper of archival records in the Chinese government during the period of warring states. But as corruption and instability grew, he felt his safety was at stake and packed his bags. Lao Tzu, however, was widely regarded as a man of great wisdom. And so, when trying to leave, a city guard recognized him, stopped him, and they began to talk. Becoming inspired, the guard asked Lao Tzu if he could write down his most important teachings. And so the book we know today as the Tao Te Ching was born. While the accuracy of the story is questionable, as is most of what we know about the founder of Taoism, the philosophical system that resulted took hold, and alongside Confucianism, became one of China's most influential philosophies of life, impacting culture on a societal level. Today, it is considered one of the world's great wisdom traditions.
Welcome to Open Door Philosophy. I'm Taylor Jones, and along with me is Mr. Parsons.
Hello, everyone.
And Andrew Graziano.
Howdy, howdy.
And welcome to episode 65, where we'll further discuss and explore the wisdom of the Tao Te Ching. But first, how are you guys doing today?
I gotta hear it from Andrew. Andrew, how's your life?
It's good. It's just a Sunday, and it's about as good as a Sunday could be. Yeah, I was looking outside today, and it looks like there's so many leaves in my yard, and I was thinking, you know, this reminds me a lot of fall, but then as I'd want to do and go outside and enjoy the nice weather, it was not fall, and so that made me a little sad. But other than that, I'm doing quite good. How are you all doing?
Yeah, you know why there's leaves on the ground?
Why?
Because the trees are dying.
Yeah.
But no joke. Yeah, it's 105 degrees today, if anyone's interested. And I believe they've categorized us as extreme drought right now. So we need some rain and the trees are turning brown. Mm-hmm. How are you, Taylor?
I'm good. I just had my first week back to class. By the time y'all are hearing this, it'll be a couple weeks in, I think, but first week, and dare I say, it went smoothly as far as first weeks of class go. Settling in, I'm in an apartment now with three of my friends, and it's a great day because the Astros are crushing the Detroit Tigers 14-0.
Wow.
So. Wow.
Yeah.
Crushing.
Yeah, oh. We've been on a losing streak.
Yeah.
I think we've only won two of the last, eight games.
It's classic Astros, though.
Yeah, we were being so good, and then nosedive. So we'll see how the rest of the season goes. But right now, doing good.
The trajectory of sports teams is fickle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I could talk about that all day.
But Houston Texans.
Yeah. So you've done your first week of school. What philosophy classes are you taking?
That's a good question. Almost all my classes are philosophy, actually, which I'm excited for, but also it's going to be a lot. So I'm taking History of Early Modern Philosophy. So we're picking up with Boyle, and then we're going to talk a lot about Spinoza. And then I'm taking History of Classic Philosophy. So a lot of pre-Socratics and, of course, Plato, Aristotle. Got to have them. And then I'm taking Social World 1, which is a bit class, but it's pretty classic philosophy heavy. So we're going to read almost all of The Republic, a lot of Aristotle's Ethics, excerpts of Thucydides, and Nietzsche.
That was a left curve.
You screwed up. They screwed up the syllabus.
Andrew was looking so happy, and then you said Nietzsche. Yeah.
I'm happy for Nietzsche. I like Nietzsche. And then my world cultures class is really philosophy heavy because it's early modern era. So we just read Fontenelle, Conversations on the Plurality of Worlds. And we're talking about the scientific revolution and how that shifted philosophy. And then comparative politics, which is not super philosophy heavy at the time being.
All right.
Yeah.
Sounds like a great schedule. You're going to be busy.
I'm going to be really busy, but it should be good.
It sounds like a lot.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you know, I'm doing good. I'm just sitting here. I'm going to crack a cold one with the boys. And by boys, I mean my cats. I've got this Waterloo sparkling water orange vanilla drink going on.
Yummy.
Quenching my thirst.
That sounds pretty yummy.
105 degree day.
Speaking of heat, it's raining here in Waco.
Oh, that's fantastic.
For the first time, probably the whole summer.
Congratulations. That's exciting.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, what were you saying, Andrew?
Mine's not exciting. Not that exciting. That is an exciting piece of news. I've been reading this huge book about Napoleon for probably the past
oh, that's right.
3 months. Have I talked about this? And it's really mm-hmm. fantastic, and so the Waterloo thing reminded me of that, because I'm about to finish, and I'm kind of sad. I actually grew to like Napoleon. He's a very bloody guy, but I don't know. I kind of felt bad for him. But I'm super, this is what it was. I'm super excited for that movie to come out. We need to do a review, philosophical review of Napoleon.
Mm.
Yeah, maybe that we can celebrate that with a Just War episode.
Oh,
yeah, that's a good idea.
That'd be a good one. Yeah.
You know, he's kind of a megalomaniac. No comment.
I don't know what that word means.
I also don't really know what that means.
Oh, he was really up on himself.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know. When you conquer most of the European powers, and you have a whole nation who...
Yeah. I guess that can happen.
Yeah.
He did crown himself emperor.
Yeah.
That's a flex.
He's a really interesting dude. I'm really surprised, because I'm not the biggest fan of the French, but I think, like, I've now my hatred will stem towards the British and the Germans, I think.
Why do you have to hate? Can't you love them all?
Well, there always has to be one, you know.
Well, you know, the British ended up winning after all, so.
Well, the entire continent turned on him. It's kind of like, you know, they made an article, they made a pact just to make sure that he wouldn't get back on the throne. I mean, what jerks. What jerks. They were all scared of him.
He took over Europe. What are you talking about?
Yeah, I know.
Why are you like a Napoleon apologist here?
I am. Yeah, what's wrong with that? They were taking over each other. Napoleon brought peace to France and Italy. He unified Italy for the first time since Rome. That's amazing.
Yeah, but then ensued in like French. 15 years of continental conflict.
Yeah. You know, I don't know what's wrong with that. It would have happened anyway.
Well.
It would have.
My favorite thing about Napoleon is that he had a brother named Jerome. And I don't know why, but that just makes me smile. I think he was placed Joseph. On the throne of either Spain or Portugal.
Spain.
It was Spain. Yeah, King Jerome. Yeah. I don't know. It just strikes me kind of funny. Well, anyway. That might have something to do with the Jackson Five, but...
You know, one thing that was not happening in France during that time is not a lot of philosophy, especially Eastern philosophy, was going on.
Oh, yeah. So much Eastern philosophy in the... Early 19th century, indeed. Well, yeah, great segue, Andrew. Let's get to it. Alrighty, guys, here we are again, back in China, talking about the Tao Te Ching. Why are we talking about the Tao Te Ching again? That's a good question. Of course, Taoism is one of the great wisdom traditions of the world, so can you ever talk about it too much? Maybe. But here's what's interesting. We've done 2 episodes on Taoism in the last 3 years. The first one was episode 21, and then we just recently did one, I guess it was back in the spring, it was episode 51, and for whatever reason, I mean, the algorithms have been in our favor. That's now like the third most listened to episode of our library, and that's not why we're doing another episode. I just thought that would be interesting to point out. So everyone go check out episode 21 and 51 if you want to hear more about Taoism today. We'll do a very brief introduction for people who are new to Taoism if you have not heard those other episodes.
If I do recall, Mr. Parsons, you're talking about your summer project of reading all through the Tao Te Ching and all of your reflections. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so... One of the reasons we're doing this is, well, I don't know what got onto me. I've taught the Tao Te Ching in class for 6 years. I really like it. I mean, I think it's a wonderful, wonderful book. But earlier in the spring, actually it was in May, I will not reveal the reasons why, but let's just say I had a lot of time on my hands where I couldn't do anything. And so, what I did have was a journal and a pen and a copy of the Tao Te Ching. It sounds like I'm in prison. Okay, let me clarify. I was involved in some academic endeavors that involved me staring at people while they took exams. So, for I don't know how many hours. It's too hard to yeah, I don't even want to think about it. But anyway, what I decided to do to kind of pass the time while I was diligently observing was I thought I'd write a commentary on each poem in the Tao Te Ching. If you're not familiar, the Tao Te Ching is comprised of 81 poems. And so I began doing that to pass the time, writing it by hand, one of these little moleskin journals everyone's probably familiar with, you know, the little 5x8 guys. And by the time I was at the end of May, I had written 30 commentaries on 30 poems. And so I just decided to keep going with it throughout the summer to just finish the thing. And I did. I would eat breakfast, and then after breakfast, I would write one commentary. And I used 5 different translations to come up with what I wanted to say. I haven't a clue what I'll do with it. I'm not even sure what its worth is. But nonetheless, it was a worthwhile endeavor for me. Anyway, that's how we ended up where we're at with this particular episode. It filled almost 2 moleskin journals, handwritten.
Wow.
And like when summer started, I could have shifted to typing it. But I don't know, it's just something about writing it by hand was attractive to me or whatever. I enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's really, that's really incredible. Well, this is a book that's, it's something that you've really delved into for a pretty long time. I mean, like this is not just, you didn't start picking up the book in May and you weren't kind of teaching it lightly. For the past few years, this is something even when you first started reading it, I think I was your student still when you just had started reading it.
You were. That was the first year I taught it.
And I remember you had bought like 5 translations and you were comparing them. So this has been something on your mind for a good while. It's not something new.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I remember that, Andrew. I would come into class. I would have 5 or 6 translations with me. I'd just stack them on the table, and we'd start going through poems, you know?
Yeah.
It was so raw. I certainly didn't know then what I know now. It's been a real learning process over the years, which is probably another reason I enjoy it so much.
And we all thought it was... No, just kidding.
Some people loved it. Some people hated it.
I think by the time we got to my class, everyone was very invested. I think that was one of my favorite things that we talked about. And we would compare usually 2 translations. I think sometimes we got up to 3, but for the most part, we just stuck with 2. But Mr. Parsons told us that every time he read a poem and like every year that he taught it, he felt like he just learned more and more about the poems, which is really interesting to think about how you can still learn more when you've studied poems 6 times and even more than that and still be finding new things that you didn't see before.
Well, that's what was really interesting about this process of going poem by poem and writing about what I thought it said. I feel like I learned even more about the poems, especially the latter poems, the ones in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. I knew those poems were about leadership and government. I just don't think I really understood just how much they were. And also, like, how subversive the text is. It's a radical text in a lot of ways. It's completely counterculture to what was going on in China at the time with the dynasties and the bureaucracy of the government. And it's a real counterculture, sort of radical text. And that came out a little more when I began going through it one by one. Well, so we've done 2 episodes on Tao Te Ching. What I figured was we would take 5 poems, and maybe they're slightly lesser known poems, and I thought we'd just see what I had to say about them. I chose 5 poems that I felt were fairly different from each other in terms of theme, So we'll just get into it. Before, though, for listeners who are not aware, the Tao Te Ching is an ancient Chinese text that was written roughly 2,500 years ago. It is attributed to the man by the name of Lao Tzu. It is believed that he was a real person. Confucius, who we do know was a real person, comments on having met him. There are some records. But how responsible he is for all 81 poems, it's hard to know. We do know that he was the inspiration for any followers who came after him that lived by the philosophy of Taoism, or what became Taoism. And so whether he's responsible for all 81 poems, or whether the poems were built off of some of his ideas by some of his disciples and followers, students, we're not really sure, but he's attributed with him. And any scholar, you know, just knows that right off the bat. The thing to know, and I chose the first poem that kind of addresses this, the thing to know about the Tao Te Ching is, well, the thing you need to know is what the Tao is. So it's Tao, T-A-O, pronounced Tao. And the Tao is this underlying force, if you will, that's undefinable, that doesn't necessarily govern the universe. The Tao governs nothing. It imposes no structures. And the belief is the closer that we can get to being like the Tao, and we'll talk about yin and yang here in a little bit, the better off we will be as people, and the better off our society will be. So the thing to remember about this is this was written during the period of warring states in China, and that was just an incredibly unstable time. And so people were looking for a way to end this warfare between all of these nobles who owned land and private armies. They were just fighting each other to end that bloodshed and that instability. And so here comes Lao Tzu, who worked in the Chinese government for many years, and he had lots of thoughts about leadership. And all that advice about leadership is in alignment with what today we would call Taoist thought. So there's a real quick overview of the Tao Te Ching. I don't know, any comments, guys?
I think it's interesting. I always think it's interesting that it's a reaction to political circumstances. And I think that, I mean, we've talked about it before, the second half of the book is more politically oriented or whatever. But do you think that when we're reading the first half of the book, well, this might be a good segue into it. Do you think the first half of the book is setting the foundation for what's going on in the second half of the book, if it's meant to be more of a political treatise, or like, what's the deal with that?
Oh, that's a great question. By the way, the book is not, there's no formal demarcation between the part of the book that talks about Tao and the part of the book that talks about mm-hmm. government and leadership. This is just something that scholars have come up with over the years. And they say the division line is at poem 37. But that's not to say there aren't some leadership poems in the first 36, and also not to say there aren't some Tao-specific poems in the remainder of the book. But it is largely broken up in that way, I can say that very clearly. Yeah, I think you're right, Andrew. It's one of those deals where can you talk about the importance of being a Taoist leader without really knowing what Tao is, and by extension, what yin is in terms in conjunction with yin yang. And so that's why if there was any organization to it, some purposeful organization by whoever put it together, it would make sense from my perspective anyway to really get down exactly what Tao is and what yin is before you start applying it to like real world situations, in this case, leadership.
And I have one more question real quick. Is the poems, are they originally put in a certain order, or is that something that comes later? Are they numbered? Do you know this?
They're numbered. There's no title to them. It's just a number.
And originally they were numbered?
So they're just numbered. There's no real, I don't think there was any purposeful arrangement of the texts. Some people will say poem 81 would be a great opening poem, or poem 37, which is the beginning of the second half, the unofficial beginning of the second half. That would be a good first poem. But of course, the first poem, poem 1, is probably one of the best known poems from the Tao Te Ching. Yeah, it's real interesting to think how it came together after all those centuries of students having written things down and then adding to it and creating commentaries of their own. I mean, by the time we're 400 years past Lao Tzu, that's about the time a philosophy that we would recognize as Taoism began. So really those 400 years, these ideas initially presented by Lao Tzu were developed over time. I don't know what to relate that to in other religions. Christianity only has one, maybe Hinduism, where you have the Vedas, as well as other texts, that the Upanishads. So the first poem I've chosen is poem 32. We're not necessarily doing these in numerical order. I wanted to do number 32 first because, again, for people who are unfamiliar with the Tao Te Ching, the first stanza deals with kind of what Tao is, and then the second stanza kind of talks about something different. But anyway, here's poem 32. The Tao is forever undefined. Small though it is in the unformed state, it cannot be grasped. If leaders could harness it, the 10,000 things would naturally obey. Heaven and earth would come together and gentle rain fall. People would no longer need laws and all the things would take their course. Once the whole is divided, the parts need names. There are already enough names. We need to know when to stop. Knowing when to stop averts trouble. Tao in the world is like a river flowing home to the sea. So guys, let's pretend that you don't know anything about the Tao Te Ching. What strikes you about any of this, of this poem?
For me, it's the line, I love this. Once the whole is divided, the parts need names. There are already enough names. We need to know when to stop. Love that. It stands out. Mm-hmm. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to agree with you that last section has always really stood out to me as well.
I think it's interesting to me because, I think it seems paradoxical to the parts need names, but there's already enough names. But also, like, who is this guy to tell me when to stop naming things to, you know? That's what I'm thinking. But I think it's interesting. It's fun. Mm.
Yeah, go ahead.
No.
If you didn't know anything about the Tao Te Ching, would some of this be confusing to you? Like, what questions would you have?
Yeah, I mean, if I was looking at it for the first time, I'd be confused, like I am kind of now reading through it. I guess it's the authority question is a question that I have. If I was someone who had been a reader of philosophy before reading this, but not had read it before, and like who is to say what? I think that's what would stand out to me. The 10,000 things stand out to me too. Would stand out to me too. Heaven and earth. I think those are the three mm-hmm. big things. So the authority, the 10,000 things, and then I forget the other thing that I said.
Heaven and earth.
Heaven and earth, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think if I had never read through the Tao Te Ching, the last line when it says Tao in the world is like a river flowing home to the sea, that would be a little bit confusing because it seems to come out of nowhere, especially in this poem, because it's mm-hmm. not really talking about the physical world. But when you read through some of the other poems, it talks a lot about how the Tao is like water and water goes to the low place. And has that same sort of imagery over and over again. So knowing that it's a familiar pattern, but without that, I'd be like, oh, why is it talking about water and rivers when it was just talking about naming things and obedience?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's really interesting. Some parts of poems do seem like they're completely disconnected from what was said earlier in the poem.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the common thought there is when people were putting this together and beginning to compile and number, sometimes it feels like you get two poems in one. Also, there's certain series of poems where you'll have three or mm-hmm. four poems in a row that are very similar thematically. And you're wondering, you know, were those originally one poem? So there are some things like that. Yeah, Tao in the world is like a river flowing mm-hmm. home to the sea. Like, okay, maybe it links with the first stanza a bit. Mm-hmm. The first stanza is talking about Tao itself. It's just stating some basic things about Tao. It's undefined. Yeah. It's unformed. It cannot be grasped. You can't harness it. But we do also get kind of a beautiful picture of what the world might be like if everyone followed the Tao. And that's heaven and earth would mm-hmm. come together and gentle rain would fall. People would no longer need laws and all things would take their course. And that's a lovely vision. It reminds me of John Lennon's Imagine, his song. But the idea here is that if we follow the Tao, and the Tao is natural, it says the 10,000 things would naturally obey. It's very similar to natural law in Western conception, is that there are these mm-hmm. things that are embedded in nature, and they're quite obvious about how we should live our lives if we could just see them for what they are. It's natural law. It's baked in. And so the 10,000 things represent just basically everything that's physical in the universe, including us, our planet, trees, etc. So if we could follow the 10,000, if we could follow the Tao, in a way it is addressing leaders. It's addressing individuals as well, but it's addressing leaders too. Heaven and earth would come together and gentle rain would fall. So it's metaphorical, of course. I don't think you follow the Tao and all of a sudden it starts raining. Maybe it does,
Maybe
everyone in...
Maybe Waco was extra Tao today, and that's why we got some rain.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, people here in East Texas need to follow the Tao. We'll get some gentle rain. Let's talk about that second half, though. When the whole is divided, the parts need names. What is Lao Tzu talking about here? Because it does seem very different from what we were talking about previously. It is paradoxical, like you said, Andrew. Lao Tzu loves paradox. So when we're talking about the whole, we're talking about a person who has yet to be taught anything, frankly. It's a child or an infant. You can also think of the Tao. The Tao is often referred to as what they call the uncarved block of wood. An uncarved block of wood is whole. Once you start making cuts, you are then taking parts of that whole away and altering it, right? And so this is a real argument for trying to be as simple mm-hmm. as possible and trying to, as originally intended anyway, when you're born. Once the whole's divided, the parts need names. There are already enough names. So let's think about when we label things. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about labeling things. Lao Tzu is giving us a warning here. When we begin to label things, now labeling things are important, but when we label too many things, it kind of creates a problem. Why might that be?
When you label something, you put a definition on it, and it's usually mm-hmm. boxed into that. Is that the correct?
Yeah.
Correct answer. Okay.
No, there's no correct answer.
No, there is. There is. What is it?
I mean, there's one closer in alignment with Taoism than else, but the beauty of philosophy that's written as poetry. You have to bring yourself to it. Mm-hmm. There's some interpretation involved. And that interpretation is, there's a great deal of scholarship on really like what the best or closest interpretation is. But as good philosophers, asking questions and probing is part of doing philosophy. And that's what mm-hmm. we do with these poems.
Well, I was going to ask you about this. What do you think that's what these poems are, less of a treatise as a handbook of Taoism and more as a educational tool for followers to engage with?
Oh, well, I think it can be both. It's certainly a tool. There's no question Lao Tzu wrote this for certain leaders in government positions to read.
Mm. Yeah.
But the beauty of any text, whether that's philosophy or literature or whatever, the ones that transcend time are ones that can be applicable in many situations, in many contexts mm-hmm. and centuries, etc. They're not bound Definitely. To a particular time period. Here's what I wrote in my commentary about this last stanza. Here Lao Tzu is referencing the whole nature of the Tao, similar to an uncarved block. When we begin to divide it, the parts need names. Society is like this. We're all humans. We're all one. But we begin dividing and naming. Black, white, Hispanic, European, Asian, African, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, wealthy, poor, middle class, developing country, developed country, Republican, Democrat, capitalist, socialist, and the divisions begin to get ugly, and stereotypes arise, and then prejudice, and then hate, and then division. We have enough names. We need to know when to stop.
That's great.
Now, did Lao Tzu intend that? I have no idea. Go ahead, Taylor.
I think when we, as humans, we want to know, and like, to know something, we think we need to label it or name it or put it in a box. But then we get so obsessed with putting things in boxes that we start to argue over the names of the boxes and what goes in the box instead of what the actual ideas are. And a lot of times we miss the point, because you can be talking to somebody and agreeing on something, but you call it two different things. So we've entirely missed what we're actually trying to talk about when we're so caught up in what we're calling things that we can't see past our own selves.
But if we can't put a label on something, mm-hmm. or put it in somewhat of a box, if knowing is justified true belief, we can't know anything then if we can't label it or put it into a box or something. And then we can't know anything.
Mm-hmm. I don't think labeling or putting things into boxes is bad, but I think it's when we forget to look past what a label is and like get too caught up in what the category is that we forget what the thing itself is.
Well, I don't know. I don't know, because, okay, look. This is what I'm thinking, right? Mm-hmm. Language is... and this is a way off field, but language is necessarily putting things into boxes. The fact that language is taking an abstract thing in our mind and putting a label on it so that we can communicate and understand it for ourselves. And if we're unable to condense something down, no matter, you know, what it is, like, we're not going to be able to understand it or talk about it or think about it. If that doesn't encapsulate the thing, it never will. That's why we have problems with our language, because mm-hmm. like, we have this problem in our episodes all the time. Like, for love, we can't talk about love because it's a thing that goes beyond what language can offer. And that's okay. It's all good. But mm-hmm. we have to do it.
I think Lao Tzu would advocate for yes and, mm-hmm. you know, or both and. Absolutely. Labels are important. But if you reduce everything, reducing is important, right? Mm-hmm. But if you become a reductionist and that's all you do, then there's no room for the interconnected nature of things. If you think about mm-hmm. If you think about different subject areas, biology, chemistry, physics, okay, that's an easy one. Those are all sciences. We just call them sciences, but they're very different sciences. And there's some crossover between those three. But if we're just going to be a biologist, then there's no room for biology to grow and benefit from the other two sciences, and vice versa. So there's danger both directions. And one of Lao Tzu's, or really Taoism's, big emphasis is on the idea of balance. And so Lao Tzu here isn't saying, like, don't name things. But he's giving us a warning that when we name things, when we name too many things, then we create division, and the world is not division. The world is interconnected. All of nature is one thing. It's interconnected. And we can reduce those things and name those things, and those things are important to name. But I think that's the message behind it. We need to be able to mm-hmm. identify things, obviously. The sciences wouldn't happen without being able mm-hmm. to identify things. I don't know. That's my take. What do you think, Andrew?
Well, I mean, I don't know, because it's like, it makes sense. And I guess that's the point of the book too. Like, him or whoever writing it down and discussing it is putting a label on it too.
That's true.
That's just, I guess, like, but to be even able to discuss it and be able to comprehend it, I mean, you have to be able to do that, but maybe there's some recognition in that you, that it's just impossible. Like, it's something that,
all right.
So I don't know.
Yeah, that's good. And, you know, I do think about this being written in the period of warring states, and how I can only imagine you had multiple different groups who saw each other as different, and that probably yeah. fueled a lot of the warfare.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's, yeah. Yeah. All right, the next poem that I selected is poem 18. It's a shorter one. Do you guys want to read it? Just to break up the monotony of me talking.
Poem 18. When the great Tao is forgotten, kindness and morality arise. When wisdom and intelligence are born, the great pretense begins. When there is no peace within the family, filial piety and devotion arise. When the country is confused and in chaos, loyal ministers appear.
Lao Tzu really enjoys pointing out things that we commonly think of as good, so he can show us that things could be better than good. And when he talks about these types of things, it really makes me think of Plato.
Mm.
His hierarchies, ascending hierarchies. And so here, in this first stanza, gosh, guys, kindness, morality, wisdom, intelligence, those all seem like good things, right? But he calls those the great pretense. Pretense is like a mask, you know, you're kind of faking it. But the idea is that there's something better than kindness, and there's something better than wisdom, and that something is the Tao. Now, if we're talking about this with the conception of Platonism, you know, you have, if we're talk about love and beauty, we're initially attracted to the body, and we love another body, but then we begin to ascend, and we move past loving the body, and we love the person, their soul, right, who they are. And then that ascends to some type of beauty that even transcends the soul. And then we end up with just some abstract thing that Plato calls the good. And for me, in this conception, if we're trying to compare it, the Tao is like the good. The good of Plato is really undefinable. It's beyond good. It's just good. It's good. And very similar here with the Tao. So kindness and morality, all that's good stuff. And wisdom, intelligence, that's good, but it could be better. And that's what Lao Tzu is trying to say here, at least in this first stanza.
So what's the deal with the loyal ministers?
That was a good question.
Okay, this is good. Okay, so this stanza is really kind of a shot at Confucianism. So we kind of need to talk about what Confucianism is very briefly. And that was a rigid system, philosophy, we could call it, of how to order society, Chinese society. And a big part of that was filial piety, honoring your parents the way they should be honored. The son honors the father. The daughter honors the mother. If the father has the dad is still around, then we honor the grandfather. There's all these rules about how society should function. And the same with government. And so that's kind of a shot at it. Although there's a part of, I mean, we're talking about yin and yang. If we go talk about Confucianism, Confucianism is yang and Taoism is yin. But if you're familiar with the yin yang symbol, those are mixed together. And so even though he's kind of calling out Confucianism, he also is acknowledging that it's a part. I think of it similar to like the relationship between the Stoic school and the Epicurean school, how they were different, but also shared some things like the idea of the virtues. But anyway, when there's no peace within the family, this filial piety and devotion arrives. Now, think about devotion. Devotion is often blind. You don't think about it. You just do it. And so when a family is in chaos or a country is in chaos, then we revert back to just doing what we are told to do is best. And so it says when the country is confused and in chaos, loyal ministers appear. Ministers in this case has nothing to do with religion. Ministers are government officials. And so you have loyal government officials who are going to keep the code, who are going to keep the law and get everyone back in line. And then now we're talking about force. No one likes that. But that's what happens when the country falls into chaos. You got to get everyone back on the same page. And oftentimes that can result in a sort of totalitarian type of government, you can imagine. But this is like the other half of Chinese society is following the rules, following the rights in every single scenario. But Lao Tzu says if we follow the Tao, like if we truly embody the Tao, we don't need that stuff.
Hmm.
The loyal ministers and the filial piety, that will take care of itself because in accordance with nature, everything in nature takes care of itself. It needs no interference. That's my explanation for it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that makes sense. Throwing some shade.
He is throwing some shade. I don't know how big of rivals they were. The one quote about Confucius having met Lao Tzu, he said, today I have met a dragon. And mm-hmm. in Chinese culture, that's about as powerful a symbol as you can come up with. I don't know. And like in my imagination, you know, Lao Tzu and Confucius like hang out and play Mario Kart or something.
That game with the stones.
They'd probably take the shrooms together.
Yeah, they probably would. But of course, Confucius would have a particular order in which to do it.
Yeah, probably. Probably so.
All right, guys, so the next one is poem 36, and Andrew's going to read it for us.
36. That which shrinks must first expand. That which fails must first be strong. That which is cast down must first be raised. Before receiving, there must be giving. This is called perception of the nature of things. Soft and weak overcome hard and strong. Fish cannot leave deep water, and a country's weapons should not be displayed.
All right. Well, so Lao Tzu is the master of paradox, and we get a lot of them here.
What I had written down when I was taking notes is that we must learn to give and not just take, and that's the way of nature. If we're only concerned with ourselves and taking and taking and taking, we'll forget that within our role in the universe, we also have to give back, because there's things that rely on us giving and not being self-centered.
This poem has a lot to do with self-centeredness and ego, though it probably doesn't seem that way on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew, you look like you're about ready to say something.
No, I'm just curious, like, what is his, who is this guy to say all of these things? Like, what is he getting this from? Is it an observance of nature? Like, is he claiming some kind of, like, spiritual centeredness which allows him to know, like, these things? Is there an answer for this? Are these maxims or poems that are meant to just be true and we're supposed to recognize the truth in them? I'm a bit confused about this.
No, it's a great question. You know, a counter real quick would be, well, who's anybody to say anything? But Lao Tzu, there was no spirituality in this. Now, that might can be confusing because we're talking, he does have a metaphysical explanation of the universe, this thing called the Tao. But if it was spiritual, it certainly wasn't overtly spiritual. And Taoism as a religion began centuries and centuries after Lao Tzu. So really, it was a philosophical way of living life. Yes, very much so based on observance of nature. And nature is but a manifestation of the Tao. I don't know. That's best I got.
I don't know what to say. Because I think, like, in some philosophy, the idea is that if we can use logic to prove at least some kind of foundation to it. In others, it's going to be something like nature, but I think more overtly, like observing physical nature and making that the foundational principles of the, like, something like a Hobbes or someone like that, observing how nature is and drawing conclusions away from that. I'm just confused what's the foundational rock here, but I don't know. That's what would bother me if I was reading this as a philosopher. But I think it's really interesting once I get past all of that, because the parallelisms are quite striking. Like, the fish cannot leave deep water, like, that's something interesting and something that seems true. And then we get to, you know, the shrinking and the expanding and failing strong. Yeah, I can get all of that. And then a country's weapons should not be displayed. Okay, well, I'm glad your Mr. Meditative Fish Guy can tell me a lot about how I should be a military strategist, you know.
Yeah, he's just observing the natural world, Andrew. And the natural world is filled with binaries, right? We have strong and we have weak, we have hard, we have soft, we have wet, we have dry. All of nature is these binaries. And that's why the yin-yang symbol involves both. That's why there's yin and there's yang. So what we're getting with the Tao Te Ching is almost exclusively the yin side of things. And Lao Tzu claims that the yin side of things is the better way of going about things, but he certainly doesn't not acknowledge that there's yang. So, you know, you can come up with simple examples like, say, like a tree in a hurricane. There are some trees that are very flexible, and they will survive the hurricane. And then there are some trees that are strong, but yet that strength is what will be their downfall because they snap in the high winds. And so there's both, right? So yin represents the flexible tree, if you will, and yang represents the strong tree. And there's times when it's very not advantageous to be a flexible tree. Now I'm talking about trees. I sound like Dr. Seuss. But there's definitely times it's not advisable to be so flexible and be the strong tree.
How can we draw these to humans? How can we draw these principles to humans, though?
Well, I think the idea is that humans are also nature.
Well, okay. Sure, but it's like an orange has a peel that you can peel off and see the beauty of the inside, and it's a delicious fruit. And so the real beauty of humans is not the skin, but the meat underneath, you know? That's something I observe in nature.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's a good principle that I should live my life by.
You think what's outward is more important?
No, I don't think the skin, peeling back the outer layer of skin is going to get me to a more delicious truth of a human, you know? It gets me to the nice inner flesh of them.
Well, if you take it not so literally, and to use the orange metaphor, if you look past the rough or tough exterior of a person, kind of the mask that they put on to protect themselves, into their sweet interior, you can learn, you know, what a person really is.
I mean, how is that?
It doesn't have to be like a literal action.
How is that any different than Plato's Ladder of Love?
Yeah, what gives Plato any authority? Well, just because he said a lot of things?
No, I think the thing about Plato is that it's at least he makes a claim that's foundational about what love is some ideal concept. And so from that, we can say, okay, at least he holds that there's something in the world that's giving a understanding of a thing its meaning. But I don't see that here. We can debate if we think that something like a form is real for Plato, but what can we debate about for this, that there's like binaries in nature? We can see that that's true in some things, but I don't know if like that's my organizing principle in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I get your point, but I mean, I don't understand how Plato putting forth that proposition as foundational makes it any more true than anything else.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Now, it does have some nice reasoning that leads to that, but
I think that the difference is that he makes that his foundational claim about forms. And he argues for that. He argues for something like forms. And from that, that's what he's drawing his conclusions to things like love and justice. But he at least is recognizing the foundation of forms. And we can debate about that if we think that's true or not. But that is where his foundation lies. But for this, I don't know why I should buy into this binary category, because I observe it in the natural world. Okay, well, take out my sight and my hearing. I don't know if that's a thing that I can see, you know, or observe in the world. Or if we even want to be a real skeptic, like, how do I know that that's not something that's just deceiving me, you know?
So maybe we're talking about methodology.
That is exactly what I'm talking about, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But maybe that's part of it.
And this is the divide. Well, now I'm labeling things. This is the divide between Eastern and Western philosophy. We could carry on with all kinds of examples and go on and on and on. The Greeks took a great many things for granted as being true, and we know today that those aren't true at all. They had their justifications for it. Cause and effect? I mean, they thought the universe had always existed. There was no beginning to it. And maybe there is, maybe there isn't. But, you know, they had things that they built, especially with the natural philosophers, the ideas that they built their scientific ideas off of, based on those axioms that they believed were justified. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. No, I get it. No, that's kind of my point. Like, they had principles, and if those principles, like, they were building ideas from those principles, and those things that they built off of those principles, like, you know, the elements of the world, whatever, those were false, but we can go back to those principles and see kind of where they messed up or where they're coming from things like cause and effect or whatever. But I'm kind of unsure about that here.
Well,
I don't know.
Yeah. And, you know, Plato had a massive a catalog of work. And then so many people have added to that and all the other Greeks. We have one book here. And
that's true.
There have been many Taoists who have come after Lao Tzu and provided clarification on a number of these points.
That's true.
But yeah. Also, again, I really like the idea of methodology. Yeah, we're not moving from premises to conclusions here like we do in Western philosophy. And maybe that's where we get into the very muddy water of the difference between, like, say, wisdom versus philosophy or something like that.
Maybe that is what it is, because I'm thinking about this as, like, okay, we were talking about this earlier as a philosophy. Let's think, if this is something that I'm thinking about for philosophy that I want to live my life by, what is making me think that I should accept it to be true? That's where I'm coming from at this. And yeah, I think that's exactly where I'm coming. And I'm trying to figure out, like, okay, well, why should I think that something like 36, the principles in that, or even 68, which we'll talk about in a second, about the virtue of humbleness, why should I think something like that is something to buy into and believe in? I don't know.
No, it's a great point. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, the difference is, if you're talking about virtues, you know, Aristotle had arguments for all of those things and why they're virtues versus vice.
There's something here. I mean, I think you're definitely right that there must be, like, either this is something that is meant for someone to think about and consider, and that's part of the exercise, or something comes after it, because this seems like it would be a big deal. So there's something else here that I think it's a reflection point, not in the, you know, calculus sense or whatever, but...
Mm-hmm. Well, gee, Taylor, any thoughts on Andrew's dialogue from the last 10 minutes?
So interesting. I mean, it's interesting to hear Andrew's perspective on things like this, because it differs so much from my own. Because I feel like just, like, seeing, like, the metaphors, at least for water, are very comforting for me. And that sort of thing isn't super perplexing. But I'm also... I don't know, maybe it's that I'm seeing it more as a wisdom tradition in a way that can potentially bring comfort in situations of uncertainty, because uncertainty is the way of life and, like, the way of the universe, versus trying to analyze it philosophically. I don't know, but I don't know how to answer Andrew's question of why it would be valid, because I don't know that there really is a reason, like a concrete reason that it would be a valid argument for the way to live your life.
Yeah. I mean, it's great. Like, I don't want to sound like a relativist here, but, like, why anybody? Why Siddhartha Gautama? Why Jesus Christ? Why anyone who claims to have some truth?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing I do like is that there seems to be a lot of parallels in Lao Tzu's advice to that of the Bible, and, like, the parables that Jesus tells. Like, even in this poem 36, when it says, "Soft and weak overcome hard and strong," I had connected that to when, I think it's in Matthew, I could be wrong though, one of the New Testament Gospels, where Jesus said that the meek will inherit the kingdom of God. That in the Bible, the weak are the ones that will ultimately overcome. Maybe it's not in this life or in this time right now, but eventually what's weak will prevail over what's strong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe that's why I like it, that I draw connections to other things, and maybe I'm not just taking this at face value, but I'm, like, seeing where it parallels something else.
No, it's interesting. That gets us to like Nietzsche and genealogy of morals, and you know, the Greek binary, if you will, of the strong warrior, the Achilles type, versus a humble hermit or a saint. And you have this dichotomy of the hero and the saint. And, you know, that's all throughout Western history as well. Welcome to our ramble. this is good.
Thoughts, Andrew?
This is good.
No, I don't know. I think there is some... I don't know. Okay, I have a question for y'all. And this is not really related. Okay. Well, actually, I am actually kind of curious, which I would say. And it's... I don't know if it's related. It's not really related to this, and so you can cut it out if it's not. But I'm curious to... have you heard of the pleasure machine thing?
Oh, where you...
Oh, the thought experiment?
Where you hook your brain up and it just like gives Frank you good Jackson things. Or someone?
Yeah, you connect your brain up and... Well, there's a lot of iterations of it, actually, but it's Nozick's pleasure machine,
Nozick,
I think.
That's right, not Jackson.
Nozick, yeah. And the premise is that you connect your brain up and you can live a complete life of pleasure and love... You know, love the world. You have everything that's good and true and whatever. Well, it's not really true, but and then you know you experience ultimate pleasure. You get anything you want, and there's iterations off of that. You know, the famous Matrix, but that's not a really fun world to live in. And the 1999 Matrix, where you're living in a desk computer job all day. But I'm curious to. I'm just. We can cut this out, but I'm curious to see what you'll say about this.
Like
about the pleasure machine?
Yeah. What would you stay in it?
No.
No.
You
no.
would
not. No.
Well, because okay, so that means then that you care about like the truth and things that are true over things that are comfortable.
Sure. Would you stay in the pleasure machine?
No, I don't think I would. But it's like okay, I don't know. We'll talk about this another time. I'm curious. We should do an episode on the
pleasure machine. Yeah. Well, it's like what's real versus what's fake. And human beings are prejudices towards what is real. And what is real is closer to truth versus what is fake. But also, if you wouldn't know any better, I mean, how would you know if you're hooked up?
I guess. I don't know.
Well... Yeah.
But, like, I think that yearning and searching for things and putting in the work, that's such a fundamental part of the human experience. So to take away that, and, like, that just makes the joy of getting something so much stronger and better when you know that you worked for it. And, like, when you have lows, it makes the highs better. So it would be so boring if everything was just happy-go-lucky, la-la-la-la-la, all the time, I think.
Yep. That is how I see philosophy and and logic and philosophy. That's why I give my deference to it. And I don't trust these philosophies that make me feel good that I can't find some kind of solid foundation to. That scares me. But maybe I should put in the work and try to figure these things out too. And maybe, you know, I'll find my nice life at the end of the rainbow and that will be good. Because I haven't really spent much time with this, so... but that's what scares me, I guess, about this kind of method. Mm. It's just, no, I do not see any logical progression. And if I try to imagine in my head a way to logically prove it, I can't. And I'm sure that Lao Tzu would not want me to do that. Would you say the same, Mr. Parsons?
Yeah, he makes no makes no claims whatsoever in this book.
Yeah.
Well, justifications, and so, yeah. rather.
And so maybe, I don't think he would want me to do that. And that's what scares me. And maybe that's just a Western way of coming to look at things, but that's what scares me about it. And yeah, I hope that does a good job of explaining my position.
No, it does. And, yeah. And by the way, the Tao Te Ching does not make me comfortable. It makes me very uncomfortable.
Mm.
It's counterculture.
Really? I'm interested to hear more about that, actually. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah. I mean, it's all like, put aside your ego. Mm-hmm. Be humble. Don't strive. Don't try to be the best.
But, you know, these are very difficult concepts to embody and love. But at the same time, aren't they somewhat concepts that are recognized by society as being noble and valuable and virtuous and good.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. You know, when you read any philosophy of life, not exclusively, but all of them begin to align along the same paths, you know? Mm-hmm. It's the idea that we should try to reduce our ego as much as possible. We should be about others rather than ourselves. We should seek community rather than individualism. All these things bring us a happier, healthier life.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds self-helpish, but like, look at so many of the wisdom traditions.
The more that you say that, it sounds true. Yeah,
including Christianity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think also a lot of times values like not striving and patience, they get kind of written off as idealistic notions of the past. Maybe that's just like the Americanism of like you have to work all the time and hustle and do all this work to achieve happiness and like burn yourself into the ground before you can call yourself happy. So it's like a pushing up against what we may think is ideal but unachievable and cultural notions of hard work gets you happiness. And like you have to kind of reconcile somewhere in the middle.
I think that's a good point. I'd be curious though. I bet a lot of most people in America would put happiness over, you know, a family or something like that over their career. Mm. But I don't know. I've met a lot of interesting
people. No, I don't know, man.
Yeah.
I mean, they want to. There's the deal. They want to. Yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But then what drags us down?
Yeah. I feel like I see a lot of people online saying that, like, they don't want kids or a family because they don't want to be tied to something and, like, have that obligation forever. So now we're kind of seeing more of a shift from where people may put happiness in a family, like in the past, above a career, but now it's a swap.
Oh, yeah. It's happening, started happening first, I think, in Asian countries, mm-hmm. but it's even hitting over in Italy's. Right now, Italy, I don't know about other countries in Europe, but Italy's having a massive mm-hmm. crisis right now about birth population, not having enough Italians. So they're really trying to push the birth rate and drive incentives. And that's not like from some war or from COVID deaths or anything. That's just like because of choice and people value their mm-hmm. career.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Lao Tzu is basically just a very, very old Henry David Thoreau. They're talking the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's simplicity, 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 simplicity. That's what Henry David Thoreau says mm-hmm. in Walden. And that's what Lao Tzu is advocating for. He's not saying don't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
He's not saying sit around and just be a bum. Yeah. No, there's nobility in work. There's mm-hmm. nobility in work. But it's the type of work and the emphasis. Are you spending 60, 70 hours a week while your family's at home?
Mm-hmm.
That's not simplicity. Are you trying to own all the things and do all the things and hustling to get it? That's not simplicity. It doesn't mean living a 10 by 15 cabin in the woods without running water. But it means like we can be off our phones a little more than we mm-hmm. are. And that's a place to start.
Yeah. And working.
Like what causes. Sorry, go mm-hmm. ahead. Oh, no, soapbox.
You're good. And working not to get glory or recognition, but working just to do your job, fulfill a job, and not because you want some sort of grand recognition in the scheme of things. Not doing things necessarily for gratitude and like to fuel your ego.
I mean, Andrew, you're already doing it. You're already being more simple than others.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you why. Your complete disdain for social media.
Yeah.
Mm.
I mean, think about, it's a mental health crisis. It's not a joke. There's research about what Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, which is now, all that stuff has done, especially to young people's, young women and young men,
mm-hmm.
And how that has impacted. I mean, the suicide rate in the last 10 to 15 years has gone up significantly. And you, for whatever reason, Andrew, have chosen to not involve yourself in social media. And maybe you did at one point and you saw that didn't bear good fruit. And so that's a type of simplicity. Your brain is quieter because of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hate social media, but the crux is that so many people that I know use it that if I don't, I'm not going to know what's going on in their lives. Like, you know, it's become one of the ways where the comparison game kills joy, but we don't talk to each other anymore. So it's hard to get any information out of anyone. People don't even call. People don't call. They hardly text. It's always like Snapchat or Instagram stories that you see what people are even doing in their lives. That it's just so impersonal. Then you're kind of at a crossroads of if you prioritize your mental peace or if you are able to keep up with people you may not talk to regularly. That's just a shame. I think it's a shame.
So what I'm hearing is, Taylor, if this video gets 10,000 downloads, you will get a dumb phone.
Well, I would have to purchase that, so no, but maybe I'll delete my social media. We get 10,000 downloads.
I'll buy you a dumb phone if this gets 10,000 downloads. I'll buy all of us a dumb phone. I would do that for sure.
I mean, this is so great. Like, what we're talking about here is how to live a good life. And yeah. We're talking about relationships with other human beings. We can quote Aristotle, man by his nature is, wants to know, but also is a social creature. And, you know, these are the types of things that lead us towards tranquility. I would say happiness, but, you know, we don't want to go down that road. But it leads to peace of mind is when we have community, when we have relationships, when our ego is out of the way and we can be about others rather than ourselves, and all of those types of things.
Yeah.
Well, just as the good employer is humble, the good podcast knows when to cut the episode off.
Know when to stop.
So, I think this is a good wrapping point. Right.
Knowing when to stop. What is it? Knowing when to stop averts trouble.
Yes. Yeah. Trouble is easily overcome before it starts. So deal with things before
they
happen.
Calm and carry a big stick.
Yes.
Doing Roosevelt quotes?
What? Oh, no, I was quoting from poem 64. But yes, do carry a big stick.
Yeah.
Well, so that was the Tao Te Ching, kind of. What it ended up being was three people talking philosophy, which, you know, that happened. Mm-hmm. You know, we should get a shirt that says Philosophy Happens. But but philosophy happened.
That's a good podcast episode. Or philosophy a good, happens. Podcast title.
That is. It's not bad. But anyway, we hope you guys enjoyed that conversation. We enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it.
But I think we're going to cut it off here and wrap it up.
Before we stop, I forget if I asked you this last time, but top translation.
Oh, my favorite translation is the Guy Fu Feng and Jane English translation.
I think I asked you this. I forget. But do you have a good commentary too? Like, how did you learn so much about? Was it just a lot of reflection, or is there a commentary book like a Cambridge Companion?
I'm the commentary. No, I'm just kidding. Red Pine translation has a good comment. There's lots of commentaries out there. But Red Pine is one of them. Lee, I can't remember the first name. Lee, I don't have it in front of me. Is another good one. There's actually in the back of this, the Feng English translation that I mentioned, there's lots of notes for a lot of poems as well, which isn't necessarily a commentary, but it explains certain things about the poems. So there's lots of commentaries out there. The great science fiction writer Ursula Le Guin has a translation of the Tao Te Ching. A lot of her fiction was based around Taoism, whether or not people know
Excellent.
That. And, you know, at the bottom of probably half of the poems that she translated, you know, have commentary on it. So when I was doing this, you know, I had 5, sometimes 6 translations, and half of them at least have commentaries in them. So, you know, and there'd be certain words, you know, that I was like, well, that's got to be written some other way, translated some other way. And sometimes I'd put an entirely different spin on the poem. And I'm not saying the Feng English translation is perfect. It's very good. It's very close to the original translation. in terms of accuracy, but also at the same time, it has enough poetry to it that you get a nice translation. I mean, it's the second most translated book in the world next to the Bible. So anyway, that's how I did it. It was kind of a process.
That's yeah. awesome.
Real dedication.
That sounds like a lot. Yeah.
It was fun. Well, everybody, that's it. That was a wild ride. Hope you enjoyed it. We really appreciate you listening, and we'd love to hear from you and hear your thoughts on the wide-ranging topics that we talked about on this episode. And so Taylor's going to help us out with that.
Yeah. Well, we would love to hear from you, like Mr. Parsons said. And the easiest way to do that is through our social media. That is Open Door Philosophy on Instagram. That's probably the best way. And if you wanted to listen to this on YouTube, please go subscribe to Open Door Philosophy. Andrew is working hard to make sure all of our episodes get up on YouTube. And hopefully at some point we will have video episodes up for you coming in maybe the near future. So keep an eye out for that.
One day. Yeah. Oh, and you know the thing, since we like railed on social media, you know the thing we'd probably appreciate the most is if you just emailed us at contact@opendoorphilosophy.com. Because, you know, I got to be honest, our social media game is not thriving.
No.
But that's because we're all kind of social media adverse. We're doing our best, people.
Yeah.
We need to hire somebody.
Maybe we should get on TikTok and get our name out there.
Oh, no. No, God, no. No.
Laozu might hate that.
I think I could master the TikTok algorithm. No, I'm just kidding. That's like my personal hell. Anyways, thank you again to Kevin MacLeod for the use of his non-social media music on our track right now that's playing. We enjoyed a lot. It's pretty groovy. And once again, thank you so much for listening. And remember, when your life is in need of some philosophy, the door is always open. Thanks.
Ciao.
Bye.